I'm really looking forward to tonight's topic. NDEs may be my favorite topic of all time. And that's what we've got tonight. Jeffrey Long, MD, is a leading near-death experience researcher. Dr. Long is a physician and radiation oncologist. So I guess he would have met with any number who have had NDEs, right? Oncology. Oncology is the medical use of radiation to treat cancer. He is practicing in, I believe it's Houma, Louisiana. Dr. Long founded the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. Over 10 years of research went into Dr. Long's study of over 1,300 NDEs presented in his book, Evidence of the Afterlife. The Science of NDE Experiences. This is by far the largest scientific study of near-death experiences ever presented anywhere. Over 4,000 actually NDEs are currently posted on www.nderf.org. That's www.nderf.org, making it by far the largest number of NDEs ever studied, and by far the largest number of NDEs publicly accessible in the world. Portions of the site have been posted in over 20 different foreign languages. This is leading to increased awareness that worldwide and across cultural boundaries, we all share these types of experiences, and they are similar to a degree that is medically inexplicable. Well, I cannot think of any question bigger in life than the one we're about to talk about. I simply can't. It is the biggest question. And I'd actually be willing to do that. All right, so fine. Let's start out with what is an NDE?
Sure. A near-death experience is an experience that's lucid and organized that occurs during a time of physical compromise so severe that physically the person is unconscious. And very often that's associated with cardiac or respiratory arrest. In other words, a heart or breathing stops around that time. But at an absolute minimum, for my research anyway, they need to be unconscious. They need to be unarousable, unresponsive, and at a time when there should be no conscious experience possible, when the brain is that far shut down, here for a certain percentage, around 9 to 18% of people that are that physically compromised, they have that very lucid, organized, and detailed and consistently observed experience, the near-death experience.
Okay. I guess if I were a colleague of yours or a doctor myself, I might say something like, "Oh, come on, Dr. Long. I think you and I both know that the brain begins to do all kinds of things during the process of death, and that these things that are seen, even though they're similar, inexplicably similar, among almost all people, are explainable by the brain doing what it does as it begins to die. It protects you, it gives you nice thoughts, it whatever." Right?
Yeah, and oh, absolutely. And that's something that I've also considered for hours and hours. Wouldn't we, and both me and other near-death experience researchers, really have all come to the conclusion that when you study the brain that approaches unconsciousness, the closer and closer you get to unconsciousness, the more absent, diminished, hallucinatory, unreal thoughts become. And as you just reach that threshold of unconsciousness, you've really got no organized, stable thinking. I mean, certainly many or most of the listeners have run into this too at some time in their life, sort of like falling asleep. I mean, the closer you get to sleep, the less and less you're thinking and the less organized your memories or ability to reason are. And yet, as you progress all the way fully to unconsciousness at this time that your brain, by all medical measurements or measurements of anybody else, seems to be not functioning at all. You're not processing information, not hearing, seeing, not aware, not feeling. right at that moment, here are people that is having not only a conscious experience, but in my survey, 75% of the people have more consciousness and alertness than their normal, earthly, everyday life. And that art's medically inexplicable. That shouldn't be happening when, by all medical appearances, the person's unconscious.
Okay. Doctor, I have noticed, in later years, that as I'm falling asleep, in the process of falling asleep, I begin to have these disorganized, interesting thoughts. In other words, no matter what I was thinking about as I was trying to fall asleep, when it actually began, I did begin having a series of, and a couple times I've, awakened at that point, and I said, wow, that's interesting. Why was I thinking about that? So...
Yeah, and that's a good point. And that's certainly an experience we've all shared. But by the time you enter a full dream, dreams are, as is generally known by people that dream in general, they jump around. Experiences aren't in continuity like they are in near-death experiences. There's often hallucinatory, blatantly unreal content to these dreams or when you're approaching the dream state. And we just don't observe that in near-death experiences. And in fact, Art, all those years ago when we were talking on the radio, and I did my at the very earliest survey I did of near-death experiencers, I asked the key question, was your experience dreamlike in any way? And that was a question deliberately worded for people to answer in the affirmative, yes, if they had any aspect of their near-death experience that was related in any way to dreams that they were so familiar with.
Right.
And I got such a resounding no response to that. I mean, people not only were basically telling me, no, it wasn't dreamlike, but Dr. Long, hell no. I mean, not even close. No way. And in fact, the response was so emphatically no to that question, I dropped it in later surveys. It almost seemed to be, like near-death experiencers were almost insulted to think that this highly lucid, organized near-death experience was related in any way to dreams that your listeners and everybody else has got generally has a lot of familiarity with. But near-death experiences are very, very different types of conscious experiences than dreams or approaching dreams or waking up from dreams, Art.
Yes, sir. All right. I've got to ask this. As an oncologist, you would deal with a number of people in very dire medical circumstances, obviously with cancer, and a certain number of those would pass away. And so it's an obvious question to ask you, if you began all of this from some experience you had in your personal practice.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, my interest in near-death experiences actually began about over 20 years ago when I was in my residency training in radiation oncology. And I was going through one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, the Journal of the American Medical Association,
right,
looking for a cancer-related article. And completely by accident, I came across an article that had the term near-death experience in it. Now, I was very studious and didn't listen to the radio as much as I should have or watch television, so I'd never heard the term before. So mystified, I stopped and read the article and was immediately fascinated. Here was this description of scores of these types of experience all around the world, remarkably similar. And clearly, even with my very first reading about this, I knew everything that I had learned as a doctor up until that time, my entire life, absolutely could not explain these experiences. And that was certainly consistent with the author of this article was writing. So I was so fascinated, I resolved right at that time that I wanted to learn more about near-death experiences, and not necessarily from reading other books or other research, but from getting the original source of the information, that being people that have actually had these near-death experiences, to me the most reliable source of information. And see for myself, I guess for several years after that, I had a burning question in my heart, near-death experiences, are they real? Knowing that if I found through evidence that they were real, that would change my entire view of the universe. Art, that was, about 17 years ago that I went through that, and even after I got my first batch of near-death experiences from my website and started my study, almost immediately I realized that near-death experiences are, in a word, real.
People seem to report virtually the same thing. You're going to be able to tell me that, but I mean, they see relatives, they certainly see a white light. But the big question, really a big one, is when people nearly die and have some sort of experience or no experience, the question is how many do have it? How many have an NDE? It's actually a relatively, I think, small number, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right, Art. At the time of a life-threatening event, including a cardiac arrest, only about 9 to 18% of people will have a near-death experience. And it's all like all or nothing. You either have a full-blown near-death experience, often with all the great detail and imagery that can occur, or you have absolutely nothing. I mean, you're literally a blank slate until consciousness returns.
I've got this long story from an atheist. And the bottom line to it, without reading it to you, is he experienced absolutely nothing. And he was quite pleased about that, actually. And I wonder if that indicates to you that he's just a victim of statistics, or he got what he believed he would get.
Well, actually, having no conscious memory at the time of a life-threatening event is what happens to between, as we said, 91 to 82% of people
right.
that nearly die, that have that close brush with death. So that's not at all unusual to me. We don't absolutely know why some people have a near-death experience and why some don't. Religious belief or even lack of religious belief doesn't seem to affect the probability of whether an NDE will occur or not, or what the content of a near-death experience will be if it does. We have a series of near-death experiences from atheists, people that, unlike the gentleman you quoted, actually was an atheist, had a life-threatening event, and had a full-blown near-death experience. Almost none of them remained atheists after their near-death experience, of course.
Wow. Okay. Is there any sense to be made, as you look across the country and look across the world, of demographics, in other words, age, where people are located, the culture they're in, their religious background, time in history, anything like that?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I reviewed 30 years of scholarly research in a book chapter fairly recently, and part of that was to discover if there was anything that would predict what group of people, what demographic group would have a near-death experience at that time of a close brush with death. And absolutely nothing kicked out. Of all the studies that have been reported, including mine too, we just can't seem to predict from anything. Gender, age, NDEs occur in the young, children, the old, the elderly, people of all religious beliefs or no religious belief, atheists. And in fact, a remarkable part of my research is it doesn't seem to make any difference where in the world you are at the time you have a near-death experience. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a Muslim in Egypt or a Hindu in India or a Christian in the United States. All around the globe, near-death experiences are strikingly similar.
All right, then let us get down to describing what most commonly occurs during an NDE. They are pretty common. This is one area where you run into a lot of common stories, right?
Oh, absolutely. Now, the interesting thing is, now that I've studied over 4,000 near-death experiences, I've seen what other researchers have found, and that is, while no two near-death experiences are the same, if you study a group of them, you see very similar elements, or if you will, characteristics of the near-death experience that occur typically in the same order. For example, there's that life-threatening event, an episode of unconsciousness, or even the heart stops. First element is typically what's called out-of-body experience. Consciousness rises typically above the body, and from that vantage point, they can see ongoing earthly events and often describe vividly the frantic efforts of others to resuscitate them and bring them back to life. Following that, they may go into or through a tunnel, and that's variably described, but interestingly, essentially never claustrophobic. It's no matter how large or small the tunnel is. Now, often at the end of the tunnel, there's a mystical, unearthly light. It's nothing like the light we're familiar with in our earthly, everyday lives. In fact, one near-death experiencer vividly pointed out that it was like a million times a million suns in its intensity, and yet it's never uncomfortable. It never hurts the whatever visual apparatus they have during the experience. Now, at the end of the tunnel, there may be deceased loved ones, people that they knew in their earthly life that died. And even if the relationship was strained, these are joyous reunions. And yes, Art, they encounter deceased beloved pets as well. We have scores of beautiful, dramatic stories of that. They may describe unearthly, beautiful landscapes, building landscapes, often colors in these landscapes that are so beautiful that they have no earthly correlate. They literally don't have the language from their whole life prior experience to describe the beauty of the colors and what they're seeing. Very often they have what's called a life review. They may see a part or even all of their prior life. And very often near the end of the experience, there may be what's called a boundary, a creek across the path they're on, a fence, a chasm, often are some of the more common ones. And at that moment in the near-death experience, they often have to decide, are they going to stay there in that unearthly, beautiful realm, or return to that earthly life and that body which is fighting to stay alive? And that's the brief, more common elements we see in near-death experiences.
Okay. I'm going to ask you hard questions because that's what makes a good interview. There, you mentioned that they frequently see those that are working on them, doing their work, trying to get them back, and the frantic efforts to try and get them back, right?
Yeah, frantic resuscitation efforts, especially for those that coded, whose heart stopped.
Right.
When they have that out-of-body experience, they're over their body and often vividly and very accurately, I might add, describe their own resuscitation.
You know, if true, for me, even that's enough. I mean, if people can come back and actually describe what was done or the order in which it was done or what was said while they were gone, you know, that's proof. However, I seem to remember, it may have been a 60-minute segment, something like that, where at one emergency room somewhere, they put a clock up. I actually put a clock up on top of equipment so that if somebody were to float to the top of the room and look down and see the clock, they would be able to say, A, they saw the clock, and B, I guess what time it was or whatever. And nobody ever came back and described that clock. And yet people are able to describe these resuscitation efforts, even things that are being said. So you knew about that?
Yeah, there's been about, we're up to six now, prospective near-death experiences are called, where they put, and they call them targets, and they can be clocks. One of the more sophisticated methodologies was actually a laptop computer that played different colors, pictures, and words. And they would be placed in an area where they thought there would be people that would have, like, cardiac arrests, not so much operating rooms. I need to keep those sterile, but emergency rooms, I guess occasionally operating rooms, but just places where people were emergency rooms, places where people were critically ill. Of those six prospective studies, there have been, as of, I think, the most recent data, 13 that had a near-death experience and had an out-of-body experience. None of them described a target, but if you read these articles, none of them had their consciousness directed toward the target. You see, when you're putting a target in the emergency room, in something like the critical care unit, you really have to put that way up on the side out of the shelf. People need to have access to the patient. You can't put it directly above them because that's a patient care area. So it's not surprising to me that people, if they haven't had their consciousness directed toward that target and they don't see it, you can't really say it wasn't there. Of course, when they have a cardiac arrest and your consciousness goes above the body, what are you going to look for? You're going to go look for a target placed in the room, or are you going to look down at that action, your own body and the resuscitation going on?
Absolutely. I was going to add that. I mean, come on, if I'm out of my body and I'm looking down at myself, possibly dead, I've got a lot more on my mind than what's on a clock or a laptop somewhere.
Yeah, and I would, you know, and certainly if anybody during any of those studies had their consciousness or vision, if you will, directed toward the target and didn't see it, I would accept that as a significant negative finding. But absolutely none of them had their vision or consciousness directed toward the target, so we really don't know. However, Art, exactly like you were just saying there, it is amazing the detail that people bring back, the resuscitation efforts. We've had people even describe details down to the number on the defibrillator unit that brought them back. I mean,
really?
The details are that accurate and that verifiable. And so, and we're not talking about a small number here. In my research database, we have hundreds and hundreds of these types of experiences. And part of my research is to go through all these experiences and see, were they wrong? How often were they wrong? Did they miss? Was they describing something that was hallucinatory that didn't happen? Mm-hmm. And that's only a few percent, a very, very small percentage that describes something that did not actually seem to really happen. So for virtually everybody that has a near-death experience, what they're seeing and what they're hearing in the out-of-body state when they come back and describe it and often go back and verify it later, it's accurate down to the finest details. And I might add, not only is it observations over their physical body, but we have dozens and dozens of near-death experiences where they're describing events geographically far from their earthly body. For
really?
Example, they code in the operating room. Yeah, their heart stops in the operating room, and their consciousness may drift outside of the operating room and actually go. We've had people describe what's being said and done in the nursing station at that very moment, in the hospital cafeteria where their friends and family are anxiously awaiting results of the surgery. And yet, every single time, or virtually every time, when the near-death experiencers investigate that later after they recover from what nearly killed them, it is stunningly accurate what they described, information they absolutely could not have known by any other mechanism unless their consciousness was actually there observing it.
Well, let me ask this, Doctor. You have a lot of colleagues, obviously, probably many of them, you know, in emergency rooms, surgeons, that kind of thing, people who have had people in this kind of circumstance. I'm sure many times, either to them or to the nurses attending them, these people come back and they're very talkative about what they experienced. Now, is it medical training that causes them to somehow dismiss what they're hearing, or are you aware that some of your colleagues have slowly become very interested in what they're hearing?
That's a great question. You know, when I started my research 17 years ago, it was typical that if the person who had a near-death experience returned to consciousness, returned to life, and started sharing it with the medical staff, most of the time they would seem to be rejected, ignored,
right.
Belittled even, and,
right.
and it was just frightening. Now, the good news, Art, is that this is a whole different era. In the modern era today, where near-death experience is so widely known, the healthcare team now generally has one or usually more people that are aware of near-death experiences that know these happen and can embrace them for what they really are, and that was very real, lucid, organized experiences. So as a result of that, now more than ever, when people are sharing with their healthcare team, they're open, they're receptive, they're interested, they often have other people. And in fact, now more than ever, people that have nearly died will be asked very directly by their health team members, well, did you have an experience? Did anything
really?
Happen?
Really, really.
You were gone from us. And so, yeah, actually seeking it out and that's exciting because that was simply, I mean, how a generation changes things in terms of healthcare attitude toward near-death experiences. And it takes a lot of courage to share a near-death experience. I mean, think about it from their perspective. They nearly died. Can you imagine what's on their mind as they slowly come to recovery from nearly death?
Sure.
And yet to have the courage at that point in time, you know, where they may be suffering, miserable, hurting, and in pain, and yet to be so convinced that their experience was significant and important in spite of all that on their mind and all they may be suffering, to go out of their way to share that with the healthcare team is absolutely amazing and courageous. And now more than ever, we're getting more and more accounts like that. And that's really, I think, probably nothing changes the healthcare team's attitude more than actually hearing these accounts from the people that had them. They know darn good and well that they were unconscious or clinically dead, and yet here are these people describing what the healthcare team was doing, saying, thinking, even if they were down the hall and far out of their room, and it doesn't take too much of that to make believers out of an unbelieving healthcare team.
Okay. Let me try this question. It seems to me that physicians, in their very, very long school and training and on-the-job training, are almost, now I have to be careful here, I guess, almost trained away from God. Is that a fair or unfair crack?
You know, I think that medicine is a very powerful, medical training, but it's not an education. You don't really have that breadth of understanding. You don't learn in medical school or in your training about very important, very real issues like God. I mean, you sort of come away thinking that all that we are, all that we think, all that we could ever be is defined by biological functions, physiological processes, chemical synapses in neurons of the brain. And so much of your training leaves me and certainly I think virtually every other physician sort of with that wow feeling. All we are is an amazing biological being. And yet you don't really understand that. You don't have that depth of training. You don't have that depth of openness in medical school training, that there is so much more to our life, so much more that we are than physical bodies. I mean, you're sitting here, all your training is focused on us being the physical, and yet my near-death experience suggests with powerful evidence that we are far, far more than our physical beings, than our physical presence.
Okay, well, that's kind of an answer from you. But I'm not sure it's an overall answer. In other words, physicians are trained in hard science, biology, everything about the human body. And most scientists, and I have interviewed many, many scientists, Doctor, I would say are not believers in God, to be frank. And
I think surveys have shown that, too. And I think and that's interesting. But you are correct, and not only from your I can imagine how many enormous number of scientists you've interviewed.
Yes,
and certainly other surveys, are consistent with that. That I think maybe people just sort of get so focused on the body and the physical self and how things can go wrong with the body and how they need to fix it that in some real way, in my opinion, they're overlooking the very big picture, and that is, there is more. There's a bigger picture. There's that vast afterlife, and there is an organization in order to that afterlife, and I firmly believe as part of that afterlife there is God.
Well, a lot of surgeons come out of the operating room just having done something quite miraculous, I'm sure with the feeling that God didn't do that, I did. You know, that person is...
Right. Yeah. We do have some physicians with a God complex. Run across that more than a few times in my life. Oh, good grief.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And my path has been very different. In doing radiation oncology, I believe, God is the great healer on the side of physicians that will let God be that presence.
I appreciate that. Hold on, Doctor. Dr. Long, you quote 9 lines of evidence from the Book of Evidence of the Afterlife. 9 lines of evidence?
That's correct, so far. And research continuing to show even more. So these are all, and you're right, these are lines of evidence from my research that all converge on showing the reality of near-death experiences and its consistent message of an afterlife.
Do you want to rattle them off or just discuss some of them? I mean, can you sort of, anything that claims to be evidence, you'll go right ahead.
Yeah, okay, sure. We'll rattle them off here. If it's taking too long, jump right in.
No, but it's long form radio.
Oh, okay. Well, certainly crystal clear consciousness occurs during near-death experiences. Now, Art, if you consider what happens during a cardiac arrest when the heart stops, of course, immediately when the heart stops beating, blood stops flowing to the brain.
Right.
10 to 20 seconds after the blood stops flowing to the brain, the electroencephalogram, or EEG, which is a measure of brain electrical activity, goes absolutely flat. It should be absolutely impossible to have a conscious experience, and yet this is a time that people very often report out-of-body experiences, observing their own resuscitation at a time when we know during cardiac arrest, measure and lack of blood flow to the brain, consciousness should be measurably impossible to happen.
Right.
And we've talked a little bit about these out-of-body experiences where people observe their ongoing earthly events and almost invariably 97-98% of the time, what they observe is incredibly accurate, down to fine details, even if what they're observing is vastly far from their physical body and way beyond any possible physical sensory awareness. And that's absolutely beyond any possible medical explanation.
All right, let me only stop you there long enough to ask you if I deal a lot with, do a lot of shows about OBEs, you know, and I wonder,
sure.
I wonder if OBEs are pretty much the same when you have them in good health as when you have them near the end.
You know, I think they are, and I think that what makes them overlaps, what makes them similar, is they're describing realistic observations that are medically inexplicable. I think that's the critical overlap, and that's why they're so important to consider both of them together.
Okay.
But no question about that. I think there's a lot of similarity there, and that's what makes actually the study of both near-death experiences and OBEs not associated with NDEs so exciting.
They are.
So I'm sure we'll have more on that in future shows, and that'll be exciting. Certainly, we haven't gotten into this, but people, the blind, including those born totally blind, have described highly visual near-death experiences. We have some case reports of those. For someone born totally blind, Art, vision is unknown and unknowable and cannot be described in terms of the remaining four senses. I've tried that with someone born totally blind that had a visual NDE, and it's amazing. So that is certainly there.
All right, I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep stopping you, but I'm curious. If somebody born blind has an NDE, in what way do they describe their experience that differs from those who have sight, if at all?
Certainly. Yeah, that's a great question. Those born totally blind don't know vision. So the one I'm thinking about that I interviewed is Vicky is her name. In her age 22, she had a severe auto accident, and she was being driven home from a singing engagement. She was a professional singer,
right,
and had a bad auto accident by an intoxicated driver. But for the first time in her life that she saw herself, her consciousness was above her body in the emergency room, and she saw a body on the gurney down below, and it literally didn't register. She didn't understand who it was. And here's where it gets interesting. She didn't even know what she was seeing. Vision was so new to her until she correlated her sense of touch of her long hair and, interestingly, the pattern on a ring that her father had given her. Only when she correlated what she was seeing with vision for the first time in her life with those prior sensory awarenesses, then she realized that was her. What's also interesting is that vision was so unfamiliar to Vicky that she was terrified. I mean, just, this was outside of anything that she thought could ever happen to her, and it was very frightening. With Vicky, this is interesting. Many near-death experiencers describe vision that's 360-degree, and that's technically a two-dimensional term. It's actually spherical. They simultaneously see, register, interpret, and understand visual things above them, below them, right, left, forward, and backward, all simultaneously. Now, that was Vicky, the blind from birth lady's experience, and in fact, even talking with her at length, she simply cannot understand why all the rest of us living our earthly life have, if you will, pie-shaped visions, why we don't see spherically. Because from her life experience, that's all there is. And she thought I was kidding when I told her we had a narrow field of vision.
That is absolutely astounding. Do other NDE experiencers with sight report the same 360-degree vista?
Oh, it's uncommon, but I have dozens and dozens of them altogether. That's not at all rare, Art. And again, it's that same kind of 360-degree vision. I mean, it's literally, you have to put yourself in their shoes. It's like our regular pie-shaped fields. You can sort of assimilate everything going on in front of you.
Wow.
Because you can see it. But imagine these people with spherical vision. They're just as you're understanding and aware of what's in front of you, they're understanding and aware of what's behind them, left, right, up, down, all crystal clear, perfect vision, and all understanding it just as we would vision that lies in front of us. And that's, of course, typically not during the out-of-body experience. This is much more commonly, in fact, almost uniformly observed when they're in these unearthly realms. But this is just one of the myriad of examples from near-death experiences, sensory awareness, is typically vastly different from what we know during our earthly life. And you can imagine, I mean, how often have you had a dream or you had spherical vision? Well, if you're like me, never. So this is just one more example of how people are having content during their near-death experiences that is absolutely, literally unimaginable to the near-death experiencer until they absolutely had the experience and experienced it firsthand. So
the story of Vicky's story is absolutely astounding, and I wonder how you felt as you listened to that.
I was just blown away. I mean, even after listening to enormous number of near-death experiences, each new near-death experience I hear is, you know, always fascinating to me, interesting, and you know, sort of like, you know, one more gemstone out of a collection of gemstones that we have in my research database. And so, but especially with Vicky, I mean, just to literally with her glasses on, and you could just tell, I mean, she had no vision. I mean, I'm a doctor, and I know blind, and she's, you know, of course, totally blind. And here she is describing things like so many other near-death experiencers, seeing deceased beings, light, things that she had were outside of her experience. I mean, it's always fascinating to talk to people in person, especially Vicky, and just hear that ongoing sense of awe and fascination and wonder in their voice as they recount their experience again. I mean, every instinct I have as a researcher is, wow, that's real off the scale when people share like that.
I agree with you, off the scale. Please continue. Anyway, there are 9 of them, I guess.
Sure. Yep, we got another one. As we talked about this briefly before, is near-death experiences under general anesthesia. During general anesthesia, you're not just unconscious, you're comatose. I mean, you can literally perform huge bodily surgery without you feeling it and never having any sensory awareness at all. And yet, due to either complications of the surgery or the anesthesia or the pre-existing illness or injury that led to the surgery, I have probably around 100 near-death experiences at this point that occurred under general anesthesia, and remarkably, they have the same elements, the same type of experience, and a key survey question that I ask in my survey is about their level of consciousness and alertness during the experience.
Right.
Now, surely, Art, if that anesthesia modified their consciousness at all, you would expect them to have less consciousness and alertness than people that had near-death experiences that was caused by other things.
Right.
And remarkably, in response to that survey question, the people that had near-death experiences under general anesthesia had exactly the same amount of consciousness and alertness during their experience as all other near-death experiencers. Even those powerful, powerful medications that do the safe and effective modern-day general anesthesia cannot modify that alertness, typically higher level of consciousness and alertness that near-death experiencers have. I mean, you could just stop right there and say, hey, skeptics, that pretty much eliminates any possibility that near-death experiences are due to brain function right there.
All right. Let me again stop you. I'm so sorry about this, but I can't help myself. There are scientists who claim that with electrical stimulation of the right part of the brain, they can reproduce an NDE. You're aware of that claim, right?
Yeah, the researcher, the main one that's known for that is a guy named Blonky from Europe. Mm-hmm.
Blonky.
I might address that. And it certainly, that's frankly, Art, that's a little bit of an urban myth. I mean, these experiments were started with Wilder Penfield, a neurosurgeon of some decades ago. One thing that amazingly was reported in relatively recently in a prominent journal was you actually stimulate the part of the brain while the people are awake. Now, that sounds like it would hurt. It doesn't.
No.
Because the brain has no pain senses. And
right.
In fact, because the brain has no sensory pain fibers, you can do these types of things, and they actually can map the source in the brain where they're having seizures. So they can try to treat seizures in certain patients. So that's why a common medical indication for stimulating the brain electrically. But this isn't that rare of a procedure. And out of the vast number of people that have had this procedure, there was only one relatively recent case report where the person sort of had a sense that one of their legs rose up. I mean, it wasn't an out-of-body experience or consciousness didn't separate from the body. But geez, Art, you've talked to so many people that have had near-death experiences. How many people describe, my torso and arm stayed in place in my head, but by golly, my leg raised up?
Nobody.
I mean, yeah, no, me neither.
I don't mean to be coming at you as a skeptic, doctor. I'm just trying to challenge you.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm on your side all the way, but I'm trying to throw you all the meat I can in terms of challenge.
And actually, I greatly appreciate that, because lots of your listeners are going to be asking the same questions, because these studies have been widely, and I probably should have brought that up on my own, because it's such a common concern that people have. But this is nothing. I mean, like a legs raising up. I mean, even in out-of-body experiences, you know, that's extraordinarily rare to non-existent. So what they were observing was undoubtedly some type of illusory thing. It wasn't even a real out-of-body experience. And even Wilder Penfield, with his extensive research, who did much more electrical stimulation of the brain decades ago, and I've looked over this and other researchers have, really never reproduced any element of a near-death experience. So the, you know, an electrical stimulation of the brain reproducing an NDE is an urban myth, hands down, not even close.
All right.
But here's another one. We also talked briefly in passing about a life review. This is one of the more fascinating things to me during a near-death experience. In a life review, they may see a part or even all of their prior life. I mean, can you imagine? They're unconscious for minutes, maybe even, you know, at tops an hour or two, and yet here they are reviewing years and typically decades of all of the events of their prior life. And in fact, some of these life reviews are so detailed that they're not only seeing how they interacted with prior people throughout all their prior life, but they actually literally become aware of, understand, and feel what the person that they interacted with felt like at the time they were interacting with them, for good or for ill, whether this was, whether this was making them feel uncomfortable or angry or joyous. All that they ever did when they interacted with everybody, they can become aware of during these life reviews. Absolutely astounding and an excellent example of the enormously accelerated consciousness that occurs during near-death experiences.
I think that a life review, doctor, is absolutely terrifying.
Oh, well, hey, I got some great news for you, and you know, lots of other people feel that way. Here's the great news. I sort of felt that way, too. I remember years and years ago I started reading about these, and I'm sure I'm not alone in saying, uh-oh, I've done some things I'm not proud of in my life.
That's
well,
right.
Here's the but that's true for all of us, Art. The good news is that even though you're seeing all of your prior life, and often there's another being present in this unearthly realm where this is going on, the great news is there's essentially never a sense of judgment. In other words, you're seeing your life, your prior life, as if to learn, understand, and maybe live the rest of your life better when you return to your earthly life. But there's essentially never any external sense of judgment by other people around you. I cannot even recall a single near-death experience where they felt damned or condemned or felt that they were, you know, in big trouble for the rest of eternity because of what they saw in their life review. And in fact, on the positive side, the life review can be among the most powerfully positive transformative aspects of the near-death experience. I mean, people that have a life review come back often as changed people. They're aware in a way that none of the rest of us could be how their actions affect other people for good or for ill. And you can imagine, if you've seen that, they're going to go out of their way more than ever for the rest of their life to treat other people lovingly, compassionately, because they've seen what their actions mean to them.
Right. Well, in some ways, that seems unfair, Doctor. Hold tight. It seems to me, Dr. Long, that judgment of oneself probably is going to be harsher than, I don't know, you'd expect from a fair and compassionate God. Judging yourself would be rough.
Yeah, you know what? Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, very often people are mortified by what they see during their life review. I mean, you know, I think so many of us, myself included, you live life and you don't even really stop to think about what you're doing or how you're interacting,
right,
how it affects other people. And when you see that vividly, no escaping it, all of it in its entirety, comprehensively throughout your prior life, and especially when you're in this unearthly realm or this overwhelming sense of peace and love, it's horrifying to see how your life so vividly deviated from that love and that peace and that serenity that's so typical in the afterlife. And it's, makes it, perhaps all the more difficult to confront what you've done in your all the years of your prior life.
All right. A lot of people believe in reincarnation. Is there probably nothing in NDEs to suggest either way with respect to reincarnation, because it seems like it would be later in the full experience, so to speak. But I'll ask anyway.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's a real good question. And in my most recent survey, we start to delve into questions like that. Great minds think alike, if I might flatter myself, Art. But I actually ask directly. The survey question I ask of near-death experiencers is, during your experience, did you encounter any specific information or awareness that you did or did not exist prior to this lifetime?
Yes.
Reincarnation, in other words, an existent. Well, this allows narrative responses, so all responses basically are in the answering affirmative. Yes, they did encounter, during their NDE, awareness they existed prior to this lifetime. And Arthur, a very surprising 27% answered yes. So only 7% uncertain. So there seems to be a fairly significant percentage of people that have near-death experiences that part of what they go through includes that awareness that we did exist, this lifetime is not the sole totality of our existence, that we had that past and apparently would likely have all that, a future experience. So that's a very this is certainly nothing I expected when I set up the survey question. So and the narrative responses corroborate this too. You know, certainly many people describe some remarkable past lives remembrances. So interesting, near-death experience evidence now starting to point to some evidence that the reincarnation may be a reality too.
Remarkable. All right, I get messages as I do the program. Radar Man has sent me one and says, please ask the doctor the following. During NDEs in which the subject meets loved ones or people that they know, there are cases in which the people they met are currently alive, or are they always deceased at the time?
Wow, great question, Radar Man. And I actually studied that formally as part of my research. The interesting thing is that any dream, hallucination, or any outside of near-death experiences, any altered consciousness involves encountering people that are alive at the time. I mean, if you have a dream or hallucination, you may recall, for example, the bank teller you did business that day with, the family member you said hi to before you headed to your bed and had your dream or what. But in near-death experiences, I've looked specifically in another major research project, looked at the same, and both of us found an identical conclusion, and that is only 4% of people in near-death experiences are alive at the time of the experience. 96% of the people are deceased, and that's just simply not something you'll find in any other altered human consciousness experience.
All right.
And what's even more interesting is we have a number of these near-death experiences that have been reported where they may encounter people during their near-death experience they thought that they were alive. And they only after they recover from their close brush with death, they realize that that person had died shortly before they had their near-death experience, and they didn't know it until they had their near-death experience and encountered the deceased. So, again, some remarkable evidence from that angle, too.
Okay. Again, through what we call the wormhole, Joe says, does he believe that one day we might develop the technology to travel at will in and out of the NDE realm?
Wow, that's a great question, Joe.
Yes, it is.
Certainly what they describe in the afterlife realm is so technologically overwhelmingly advanced compared to what we have on Earth that it almost seems unimaginable. And yet I'm a great believer in the human spirit. I'm a great believer in all of us, slowly humanity moving toward that technological increased awareness. And I think it's distinctly possible that we may someday converge through technology or through human understanding or growth in a variety of ways world globally, that we may end up potentially being aware of and potentially even interacting in a way we cannot even conceive of now with this overwhelming, blissful, loving, peaceful, what we call afterlife, which is perhaps another perspective as a simply a part of the greater reality that we're just not often aware of.
Do you ever feel, Doctor, that this is an area that we ought not be tampering in? In other words, this is an area reserved for, well, that great question of what comes next, and we have no business inquiring into or tampering in this area?
That is an awesome question. I've spent a large amount of time considering my research and being wondering if we are learning about something, becoming aware of something that we're not supposed to know about. I mean, clearly on Earth, as you go through your earthly life like me, you don't become aware of an afterlife, of all that's there in the afterlife, your deceased loved ones, the beauty, the wonder, the peace, the love that seems to rule there. And I've reflected on that. Is this really the right thing for me to be doing, to try to bridge that gap, to help people to understand that that's a reality and understand a little bit about the afterlife? And after a great deal of wrestling with that question, I've decided, yes, I think that really is the right thing. I think the afterlife is revealing itself in bits and pieces to us, more dramatically in near-death experiences, I think more subtly during the life experiences that probably each and every one of us has. And I think that's just part of the way things are in our earthly life. I mean, it seems to be, if you will, a part of humankind's meaning and purpose is to continue to grow closer to that source, that afterlife.
So you're not worried, Doctor,
where we came from.
That when you get to the pearly gates, they're going to say, aha, Dr. Long, wrong floor. You want to punch sub-level 94. Just
no, I think the universe is ruled by love. We're okay.
Yeah, all right. Once again, Dr. Long, welcome back. And yet another question from Mark through the wormhole to settle a debate. Can the chemical DMT account for an NDE, and what is DMT?
Yeah, DMT is a psychoactive drug, dimethyl, and then it gets into polysyllabic wording after that. But DMT has been studied as a hallucinogen. Some researchers are thinking that its use under controlled clinical circumstances may reproduce some elements of near-death experiences. I've actually been in communication with some researchers that have used that formally in investigation studies. Certainly it can induce a sense of great peaceful feeling, can sort of create a sense of a mystical feeling, but does DMT reproduce near-death experiences? Absolutely not. I have yet to encounter a DMT experience that significantly reproduced any typical near-death experience. So while I think it's intriguing, there doesn't seem to be much overlap, and that's actually true of other psychoactive or, if you will, brain-acting chemicals. They can certainly create some superficialities that somewhat resemble a near-death experience, but no chemical can reproducibly cause anything like a near-death experience.
Gotcha.
Unless it causes clinical death.
All right. Do you have any reports, and this is a big one, of negative NDEs?
Oh, we sure do. And then in the scholarly literature, they're referred to as frightening because certainly that's the dominant emotion, obviously, in these types of experiences. And I've actually investigated that myself. Out of the 4,000 near-death experiences I have, certainly there's a small percentage where there's a portion, not all of the near-death experience, but a portion of it where the dominant emotion was fright. And that can be due to a wide variety of things, the unfamiliarity of the experience, etc.
Of course.
But I think what most people are thinking about when they think about a negative or frightening experience is are experiences that are objectively frightening. In other words, they're literally in a hellish realm. Hellish experiences are, of course, objectively frightening. And I only have about, of all the 4,000 near-death experiences I have, we only have about 1% that were truly hellish in part or in all of the experience. And in looking in that group of experiences, it's very interesting. Certainly some of the most frightening stuff art that I've ever read in my life. I mean, you can read fictional frightening things, go to frightening movies, but some of what is described in these hellish NDEs is literally off the scale in terms of being spooky. Now, the important thing, I think, to take home with this is that even if people have such a horrific experience, that doesn't necessarily lead to them coming back believing they're condemned or they've been especially bad people. Very often, people that have these types of experiences come back and say, ultimately, often months to years later, after they've had a chance to learn from it. But many of these people come, if not most, come back and say, you know, I needed an experience like that to learn some things, to let go of that anger, guilt, resentments, and really live the rest of my life with that much less of an issue than it was before the experience.
I know. It doesn't seem fair, Doctor. Doesn't seem fair. In other words, some small portion of people get this experience and get to reshape their life and then presumably get a better outcome next time they exit.
Well, you know, don't forget these types of dramatic life changes are, and that's a good point, but these kind of dramatic life changes and sort of a renewed desire to continue living your life in love and compassion and peacefully is very commonly observed in people that have the typical pleasant, blissful experiences. So there's a real overlap in what we call the after effects of near-death experience for those that have had the frightening, hellish experiences and those that have had the blissful experiences. It's like all roads lead to Rome. All of these paths for the unique individuals that they are seem to be important to them for that point in time in their life to help point them the proper way, the proper path.
All right. I have more questions, but I have hogged you, and a lot of people want to talk to you. So if you wouldn't mind, we're going to take some calls. And here we
Let's dive right in, Art.